Hey, 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 conscious leaders, a warm welcome to yet another episode. Here we are dropping a webinar replay we've had with three economists, Bronwyn Williams, Kanisa Peak, and Sanisha Pakirisamy. We spoke about the importance of using your vote to create a hopeful future and how important your vote is, but more importantly is how to vote strategically and some interesting nuggets of wisdom and things that you can do with your family in order to decide who to vote for. This is a very important time in South Africa's economy. It is a very important time in South Africa's political landscape and also for our youth and how we can make better decisions to create a better future for our beautiful country, South Africa. So now, listen in to an enriching conversation and hope you find inspiration.
How are you doing today, ladies? We are taking on quite a tough topic today, aren't we?
Very necessary though, yeah.
Very necessary. So without further ado, what I would like to do is to introduce you to our panel here. So on my left, I've got Sanisha Pakirisamy. She's an economist, but she's also a columnist for Financial Times. And then we've got Bronwyn Williams. She serves on the Conscious Leaders Advisory Board, as I'm sure you've seen. She's also a futurist. She is a partner at Flux Trends. And she's a podcaster, and she's an author, and I can't think of, there's so many things that she's doing, and she's involved with United Nations, and gosh knows, I don't know where she finds time in her day. And then we've got Kanisa Peak, who is also on our Kanisa Peak, I have to say it correctly, there's my dyslexia going over there, who's also on our Conscious Leaders Advisory Board. She is on the APSIP Women's Forum. I think you're vice chair there, right?
Correct, yes.
And then also an economist at one of the big banks and VP of Risk, which is also a very big task, the dragons that you need to slay in the day. But thank you. Thank you for being here. So maybe you can just give me some time to introduce the topic. So we decided to talk about this whole idea of how we can ensure that this season that we are going into where voting needs to take place, what can we do and can we maybe also understand what the impact of not using your vote could be. As we saw in the beginning, is, you know, many women couldn't vote many years ago, but now when we look at the voters' role, many women are actually leading in the voting. So how can we as women, but also as men, how can we use our votes to bring the change that we want to see in South Africa? So I think I'm going to open this question to you, Bron. I want to understand from you, based on the interview that I've had with you on the podcast, we spoke about democracy being at a crossroad. And I want to understand, is there cultural deposits from globalization that is also impacting this? What is your entire view on this?
Yeah, in terms of cultural deposits, I think that's less of an issue here in that only citizens get to vote. However, there's quite a big catch there in that our world is arbitrarily divided up among nations. None of us chose which nation we were going to be born into by the lottery of life. We were allocated a certain set of parents at a certain place at a certain time with these sort of arbitrary borders around us that determine our sphere of influence. It's not entirely fair, but it is the realities we have to work with, right? And that we know the most important challenges of our age are effectively borderless. Even if we look at our interest rates that we're paying on our mortgages or on our cars, these are generally, a lot of their effect is to do with global monetary policy, right? When America sneezes, we catch a cold, is the old cliche. And these things are still true. The foreign monetary policy affects the price that we pay in our supermarkets for cheese or for bread or for tomatoes, wherever it is that we're shopping for. Likewise, whatever China does, whatever Russia does, whatever the EU does in terms of burning coal or not burning coal, it has an impact on our planet. It has an impact on our climate. It has an impact on our weather, whether we run out of water in Cape Town or Johannesburg or not. A lot of these critical things, the access to food, the access to a livable environment, are the consequences of people who are voting in other parts of the world. So we can think about that, but we can also think about it from the other perspective, in that the government that we vote for in South Africa is also going to make choices that are going to impact people that don't just live in our country. They're going to also make decisions that are going to impact people that live all across our continents and even across the world. Again, if South Africa doesn't make a transition to green energy, we're pumping dirty coal, not just into Limpopo and into Mpumalanga and shortening the lives and the quality of life of our own people. We're also poisoning the air of our neighboring countries, right? I mean, these are very sort of small examples, but hopefully they get the point across, because we can't, like, the border doesn't control the weather, right? So I think that we have to take our responsibility as voters very, very seriously, not just for the citizens within our nation that we happen to be born into or have immigrated into, but also by our responsibility to future generations and also to global future generations. We do have an impact and a responsibility on making choices that are going to impact people across space and across time.
Fantastic. Thanks for that input. Sanisha, maybe you can lead us into understanding what is apathy and how do you see its behavioral and the behavioral economics within the work that you do?
Yeah, so, you know, when you talk about apathy, I think we need to think about it in the context of being disengaged or disillusioned. It effectively is a disconnection from with yourself and your living reality. And I think it's playing out in a number of aspects globally and locally. One of these aspects could be, for example, in the workforce. So just after the global COVID-19 pandemic, people started to talk about this term called quiet quitting, which is effectively almost a disengagement in the workplace with employers and employees. And what happens there is employees don't want to give all of their time to workplaces anymore. They're trying to find this work-life balance. They're effectively becoming a bit disengaged in their work environment. And so by doing that, they effectively not giving their best, productivity levels and efficiency levels do drop. They are, however, doing the bare minimum so they don't get fired, but there is this sense of quiet quitting. And so that's one aspect where you can see, you know, a loss of productivity coming from an increase in apathy. We can also see things like in global situations with global issues coming about. And it's unfortunately not a nice example because of the way it's panned out. But if we look at war in the world today, I think it was the Time magazine that said, you know, we're not experiencing a world war right now, but we are experiencing war in the world. And so if you look at what happened with Gaza and Israel, if we look at what has happened with Russia, Ukraine, more than 2 years into that, if we look at the war in Sudan, political issues in Myanmar, but it almost seems as though global citizens are almost sitting on the sidelines and not really getting actively engaged in that. I think you could also find apathy coming through in the likes of cultural promotion. So I think, you know, in certain spheres of the environment, we're finding that people are not really giving full support in order to promote cultural diversity. And so you're not really seeing people supporting different ideologies, different opinions, different groupings, and effectively different institutions supporting that cultural preservation coming through. And then lastly, what I think we'll probably spend quite a lot of time talking about in the session today is around political apathy. And that's essentially citizens taking a bit of a backseat and not becoming engaged in the political and economic discourse of the country. And of course, that has a direct impact on all of its citizens. However, there is almost this fatigue around the political discourse, and that has led to political apathy in a sense.
And Kaisa, what is your take on that?
So, you know, Sanisha made quite a very valid point. I do think that, you know, apathy, people get to a point where they lose that engagement. If you think about where we were in 1994, there was that euphoria of a change in a system. There were uncertainties even in those days. But when you think about how corruption has filtrated through the economy, how lack of service delivery has impacted many regions, particularly in the municipalities, you'll remember that there was an influx of immigration that happened where people left their provinces to come to the more urban areas. And now after COVID, we saw that people were now returning back because to their rural areas or their places of birth, because there were no longer those golden opportunities that you would get. And I think, you know, this is not something that happens overnight. Apathy doesn't occur just because of these elections. I think it has been a build up of all the negatives that have been happening with our leadership in terms of the political stance of the country, or the political leaders rather of our country, and all the allegations of state capture influencing that. I think more importantly for the youth and many women is the unemployment rate that continues to skyrocket, limited work opportunities that are available. And, you know, you'll remember that during COVID, it was the youth, it was mainly women who suffered back on the job losses because of the extra activities that they do for caregiving, activities that they do for their home, and you know, with crime also very high, you know, you can link that to an economy that's not growing fast enough. You can link that to an economy that cannot generate jobs, and we can say, you know, that we are not skilled enough to move with the adapting times of, or the youth is rather, there's a skills gap that's occurring in our country, and we cannot catch up with the fast changing world, making it even more sustained or protracted where we are. But I do get a sense that, you know, there are few South Africans who, I mean, I think the Ipsos survey showed that, you know, 7 out of 10 South Africans still believe in voting as a measure of getting their democracy showed, although they do not believe in that the democracy is actually working. So perhaps that also challenges us to say, if democracy isn't working the way we expected it to work since the 1994 elections and the subsequent ones, perhaps this is the time to change that and try something new.
Bron, if I might ask you, if you can perhaps shine a light for us on what is the manifestations of apathy and what causes it specifically?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note the difference between like apathy and laziness, the difference between apathy and drawing borders and, you know, boundaries, right? So you can go back to what Sanisha was saying earlier around the lazy jobs or the minimum effort Mondays, the lazy girl jobs, all of that sort of thing. There's that conversation is a complicated one, especially in the context of apathy, because there's also almost a bit of activism that's going on there. This is a hard stance in terms of my boundaries between my work life and my home life, or my time and the time that belongs to my employer. So that's a sort of nuance there. But however, apathy comes in when during the time that you're actually on the clock being paid, you're not putting your full effort into your job, you're not fully engaged, you're not taking control of your own destiny, you're not putting your best in to get your best out and to get meaning out of your day-to-day life. So the work-life conversation is a nice way to sort of crack it open, but it isn't the full thing. Because apathy, unlike laziness, is almost a sense that whatever I do, it doesn't matter. It's not just that I'm not doing anything. It's like there's no point in me doing it. Mm-hmm. And it can almost be compared to depression. If everyone has ever been so unfortunate as to experience depression, it's where you have the sense that nothing you do can get better. It's almost like a numbness, right, that comes over you. And I think that it has been prevalent in South Africa until this point, especially since we've had a democracy in name, but a democracy dominated by a one-party system effectively, right? Although you could vote for anyone, everyone kind of knew when election seasons rolled out who was going to win. So it was kind of the sense that even if I do vote, there's going to be so many more people that are going to vote the other direction. It's a drop in the bucket. It's a performance art. It's not actually going to get me anything. Very similar to trying to apply for a job when you're a graduate that has just a matric or doesn't have any qualification. You know that 1 in 3 South Africans don't have a job. You're like, I could go apply for this job, but I know I'm not going to get it. It feels like there's no point in even trying because it feels like the outcome is rigged against you. It feels like the outcome isn't influenced by your actions, right? And that's why your title for this thing was The Hope Stealers, right? The sense of apathy is a sense of having your hope stolen. It's having a sense of your agency and your free will being diminished to the point that your contribution is diluted to such a level that you don't actually have an influence in the outcome of your own life, of your own society. That's quite a paralyzing effect. And unfortunately, for many young people in South Africa, this has been the reality for most of their lives. They were promised a whole lot of things, but it was a false promise because it was a promise that they were unable to attain through their own initiative. And once you've tried enough times and you've been pushed back through a system that's so much bigger than you, you kind of give up on trying. And that's where we are with apathy, and that's why it's such a dangerous space to be in. However, I do want to also say that we mustn't get stuck on the negative only. I think that it's really important also to note that suddenly, within the last couple of weeks, your vote matters a whole lot more, and your vote could actually tip what happens in South Africa, because our political situation has shifted almost overnight with the advent of the MK party, which suddenly means that maybe the DA won't be the de facto opposition party. That suddenly the ANC's majority is small and not large. Suddenly, there are horses in the race, and that means that your vote could tip the scales in terms of which coalition gets formed post-election, because there are now options on the table. There's not just one future. There never was. That was always the lie. Talk about that. But suddenly, that lie cannot hold up to scrutiny, right? And I do want to talk about that lie, because that was a lie. When we told the stories as a nation to each other that the outcome of the elections was determined, that the biggest party was so big, it doesn't matter who you vote for, your future is set, we kind of stole that future, that choice, from young people and from young voters. Because we do tend to believe the stories that we told by our societies, by our parents, by our elders. And those stories are stories that preserve the prevailing status quo, right? These are stories that reinforced the wealth and the wealth patterns in our society, whether you want to talk about capitalism, you can put in that too. They're stories that reinforced the political patterns and the fact that we had a very unbalanced democracy, those sorts of things. But by getting people to believe that that was the only story, we kind of stole that agency that allowed people to think that their actions mattered. And I think it's really exciting that COVID kind of took that story away in terms of a lot of our dynamics with the workplace, forced us to sort of look behind the curtain and see how some of the stories we had told ourselves and believed weren't actually true. And I think it's really exciting that having a bit more dynamism on our political menu and a bit more uncertainty actually increases our agency and is a huge lever to reverse patterns of apathy that we've become accustomed to. We must always remember that apathy favors the status quo. It favors the richest. It favors the most powerful, right? And that's a story that I'd like to tell to any young person.
That is so true. I mean, we had a discussion on the podcast about that, you know, it's always going for the middle class and creating apathy with the middle class, and that is where it gets scary. Mm-hmm. But I mean, also from an economic perspective, how are you, can you add to what Bronwyn has just shared with us? Sanisha, can you please take it from here?
Sure. So I would say that, you know, apathy, how it's come about in the South African environment, could be a little bit nuanced, because we do have an urban and a rural population when we talk about political apathy. So generally speaking, you would have your older age cohorts that tend to go out and cast their ballot a bit more often than your younger age cohorts would. And there's various reasons for that. And I think it is also geographically dependent. So, for example, if you live in the United States and you're an older citizen, things like Medicare, your pension, social services is quite important. So you want to be part of that political discourse. I think also for practical reasons, the older generation would have more time to go and queue up and vote on the day. Now, your younger age cohorts, as Kanisa also picked out earlier, are very heavily influenced by the socioeconomic dynamics that they're currently facing. So if you're in an environment where there is load shedding, water shedding, high food and fuel costs, high interest rates, you almost get stuck in that realm of thinking that this is the status quo and it's going to prevail. And in that kind of environment, I think apathy then starts to set in. So for the youth, I think that, you know, we've got this high level of apathy starting to seep out because of this consequence of the socioeconomic failures of the current ruling party and how that is set in. I think that if you also had to broaden the scope a little bit, you also find that the youth may not have enough time, for example, to go out and do the vote. They have maybe studies to attend to or work to attend to or family responsibilities. Also outside of that, I mean, we spoke about, you know, the difference between apathy and laziness, but I think there's also a third aspect here, which is barriers, physical barriers to go out and vote. So for example, for the older age cohorts who are sitting in a rural area, South Africa is only 68% urbanized. So there's at least, you know, 32% of people that have to go and cast a ballot in a rural area. And in that case, it means you might have to find transport to get to your nearest polling station. We also have a very high number of citizens that don't actually have a valid form of identification or an ID book. And so these sorts of barriers then also start to creep in, lowering the propensity for people to go out and actually cast their ballot in this kind of environment.
Kanisa, how are you seeing this manifesting in the economic dynamics?
I think it's important to note that, you know, when we think of coalitions and how they've played out in municipalities, it does get a sense of increasing that level of apathy, right? People thinking, but things are not really working in the areas that we live in. It doesn't seem like we have political maturity in this country. So then they would then decide, you know, perhaps not to vote. But I would urge that, you know, if you engage with what the political parties are offering and you understand what the country needs, there is going to be, I think, a level of having to some level of giving from our political parties, because those things are not going away. You know, reforms need to be implemented. So I know that on the 29th, when we vote, it doesn't mean the government will be formed immediately. Perhaps even 5 days after that, we'll know immediately who the parties are that can be our government. But then it takes a little bit of a few weeks or so to actually form a government. So there are things that I feel if we are active citizens, we would know. For example, all of the parties have been, you know, sharing their manifestos, whether through live shows or they've been doing it on radio. Even some educational institutions have been hosting. I think I attended some at Gibbs. I think Bloomberg was also running a breakfast session or series with some of these political parties. And that is an opportunity for citizens who feel uncertain of who to vote for or how to, you know, to lay out their vote, to actually engage and ask those questions to these political parties leaders directly to say, you know, these are the things that we're worried about. Your manifesto perhaps addresses these issues. What about the others that perhaps you feel strongly? And I think that's the beauty of democracy, that we have that ability and liberty to actually engage at that level. So I do get a sense that, you know, our policies that will drive growth, those should be sustained, even with a correlated national government. Where we as citizens would need to, I suppose, stand up is to take action in terms of holding those leaders accountable. And by not voting or by not participating in these kinds of series or interactions, or if government gazettes something and we don't participate in it, we're literally saying, we've given you the power, you do as you please, even though we're not happy. And that's the beauty of how South Africa has been, really. Having the opposition party also helps, you know, us be aware of things that are working, things that are not working, so that we can actually, as citizens, follow up. And I think there's no economy without the people. So, in fact, we do need to participate. I don't know how, you know, I make this example to my peers to say, how are you running a household? Because if you don't understand what's happening in your house, you can't necessarily say you need to have, say, maybe curtains or certain foods. You need to be engaged. You need to understand what you have and what you don't have so that you can at least get the ability to access the things that you don't have. Community, I think, requires that we hold each other accountable. I don't know how many of my friends have literally SMS to say, have you registered during the registration process? Now I'll be hounding them to say, are you voting? Are you on the queue? Send me a picture. I want to see that you are actually out there going to cast that vote, because Not knowing, I think that's the lazy part. Not knowing who to vote for is because you haven't taken the time to actually engage those political parties that are available to us. We even have individuals. We have the multi-coalition party as well, where a grouping of parties that have similar values that have grouped together to say, you know what, we have a similar vision and we want this to work this way, and they are willing to work together. So there is a sense of what are we as individuals, how are we holding ourselves accountable without having to always push back to say it's the leaders who are not fulfilling their role.
I love that. So I always know how to connect the dots when I talk about marketing, right? Because there's always a connection, as within, so without. So, first thing, this year they announced a $600 billion of the Hermit consumer. The Hermit consumer generating over $600 billion worth of revenue. So when the world is scary out there, I don't want to go outside to go and buy my shopping. I'll just buy everything from here. We have the keyboard warriors, people that are always saying, I want this change. I want you to do this thing and I want you to do that thing, right? Then if you think about it, I interviewed Dr. Melanie Van Roy. She's the CMO of Clix, and we started talking about ethical beauty. And she says to me, you know, Body Shop, what we had to do was we did all of our research. Everybody said they wanted ethical beauty. We then asked them what they wanted, how they wanted it. We spent a fortune getting the product in store. And then when they got it in store, nobody was buying it. And then they said, bring the smell back in the product. And the product doesn't have a smell, but it's the smell that's bad for you. It's all the things that doesn't smell good, right? So there's a disconnect for me, because I feel like there's a lot of, yes, I want this and I want that, but when it comes to taking action, it's a different story. There was, I think it was last week, there was I think it was Harvard Business Review that mentioned that people are not reading beyond the headline. So in a time of misinformation, now you just see a headline and you're just assuming you are interpreting that whole headline as gospel as to how you're going to vote. So, Bronwyn, I'm giving you that ball, and then we're going to fly around.
Sure, yeah. I think there's just a point I wanted to make around different types of voter apathy. So we think about voter apathy as being voters who don't register or who don't bother to go vote on the day, even though they are registered, right? But there's another sort of voter apathy, and that's the voter apathy of the people that maybe even do go vote, but see their vote as being the end of being a citizen, right? The end of their contribution. You're like, I pay my taxes, like they come off my PAYE at the end of the month, and I voted, and that's my contribution to society. I'm done. And that's also inaccurate, because the whole idea of democracy, I think we've discussed this before, is that it's supposed to be governance by the people, for the people. And that implies you actually have to contribute to society. So my business partner just wrote an article in the Business Day a couple of weeks ago now, talking about exactly this, active citizenship. And if you're seeing a problem, you've got to fix it, especially problems that can be solved by individuals that would be very expensive for government support to solve. Things like making sure your neighborhood pavements are looking good, right? A small act, but it's a big act. Cutting down the grass makes your whole neighborhood safer. It means less crime. It means more eyes on the street. It means your neighbor's property value goes up, all those sorts of things. The really simple sort of acts of actually being a citizen within a society rather than just being like an isolated individual. And I think that that's actually the root of so much of our apathy in society, is our ideas of extreme individualism that atomize us from society and see us as being clients of the state rather than participants and citizens within a country, right? Because if you are a client, you have every right to sit back and complain when the lights don't work and to point fingers at the people you're paying to do a job. But you've got to also kind of understand that it's not as simple as that. We have delegated leaders to help work for us and with us, but we haven't given away our responsibility to act, right? So that's perhaps a slightly more preachy way to look at the whole apathy question, and also to put the ball very firmly back into the hands of people who are often most quick to point to young people and say, they're the problems, they don't bother to register, they're not voting, they're not participating. But quite often, those are the very same people that aren't voting are participating in different ways. even if they're misguided about the efficacy of their votes, and we must change those narratives and those conversations we're speaking about, they might be doing other things outside of the system. They might be joining student protests, for example. They might be setting up citizen movements. And all of these things are also part of a vibrant society and are antithetical to apathy and should really be celebrated, right? The more we can do with each other and for each other, I think, is a great antidote to apathy, to nihilism, to non-participation. And it starts with seeing your role in society as being not a non-playable character, as they say, as being an actual playable character, you know, joining the great massive multiplayer game of life, right?
Yeah, no, we need some protective equipment for us. Well, I'm not going to say the whole sentence, oh, Marilis. Do you remember, oh, Marilis? Yeah, no, yeah. Like I'm spinning into a pole over there. But I mean, if I just want to ask you, Sanisha, we're talking a lot about apathy and we're talking a lot about leadership. Bronwyn, I know that you had a paper that you wrote about this leadership vacuum. And how are we supposed to vote strategically, knowing that we don't have the leaders that we require or that we are necessarily happy with? Although there is hope, I'm not saying there's not, but there might be a sense of loyalty to certain parties, and now hope and apathy is like a gray line and you don't know where to go. What is your opinion on that, and how do you take action and strategically?
I think it all boils down to those misconceptions again. So, for example, why should I cast my ballot? It's not going to matter in the end anyway. And I think it was Bronwyn that also mentioned, but now we are at that point in time, and you can see this globally where the voter base has fragmented to such an extent that victory in elections is quite marginal. So you could be one of a couple of swing votes that does tip, you know, a certain political party into power. And I think that has shifted from, you know, a good couple of years ago when we were almost seen to be a one-party state, in which in reality we're not. We do live in a society where we have a multi-party system. You know, the other common misperception is, you know, I'm not going to vote for my party because, you know, there's going to be 10 others that will vote for them and they will secure victory anyway. But again, that takes away from your democratic right to cast your ballot and to be able to do your civic duty, which I think that the older age cohort, you know, we're speaking about the difference between the older and the younger age cohort and how apathy differs there. And I think they've got this civic duty in mind. So I think it really boils down to that. The third aspect, which is what you mentioned, is that sometimes all political parties get painted with the same brush. We can't trust any of them. They are all corrupt. And again, it points to Kanisa's picture around educating yourself on the various political platforms that are available, what the political parties stand for, you know, reading through the manifestos that they've presented so far, and looking at the differences, because again, there is a diversity of views out there, a diversity of a vision for South Africa, and a diversity of how we get from point A to point B. So I think we need to take that into account. I really like what Bronwyn said about activism. It's almost like a grassroots activism, you know, fixing the pavement outside your house. It doesn't necessarily have to be done on a national level. And I think community-based activism is the best way to approach it, because you living in your community know what the society in that community is facing. You know the trials and tribulations, and you know what needs to be fixed in that particular area. I think it's very difficult for any specific individual to fix things on a national scale, but it's much easier to do that from a community-based approach. And I think it's very important that we do exercise our, you know, democratic vote, because if we don't, we do risk this, you know, phenomenon of democratic backsliding. Mm. So we see that in Africa, we've actually only got 8 countries that are, you know, presumably free and fair. We've got free and fair elections playing out. And I think that in that kind of environment where the world is moving towards more strongmen leadership or autocracies or populism, we do risk an environment that could potentially lead us to a higher inflationary outcome. Because in that kind of world where you have more populist leaders and more protectionism, we find that more trade barriers come up. It's not so easy to see the global supply of traded goods and services in that kind of environment. So that pushes up prices. It can also depress growth in that environment. With a strongman leader in place, you know, you've got to make sure that your citizens are happy almost at any cost. So you could lend yourself to higher debt levels, leading to, you know, more free rein on the fiscal situation. I think in that environment, there's less transparency. You know, there's fewer checks and balances in place. It could lead to an environment where we get more, you know, corrupt action. So we don't want to end up in an environment where the global economy looks like that, where there's more protectionism in place, higher inflation, lower growth, less transparency. We want to aim for an environment where we can get global cooperation on matters that are important for everyone, such as, you know, all aiming to combat global climate change, as an example. And I think that, you know, to promote the Sustainable Development Goals, as an example again here, we want to see more global cooperation taking place, rather than countries, you know, putting up those barriers that we spoke about earlier and those borders, which can very well happen in an environment where there's this democratic backsliding.
That's very, very good input. Thank you so much, Sunisha. Kanisa, oh, your name sounds so similar. Kanisa. I like it. Okay. The one thing I just want to ask, digital divide is a big challenge that we have in South Africa, especially as you mentioned early on, Sunisha, you know, with the urbanization, how many you know, people actually don't have access to all of the fancy online smartphones and actually accessing information. There's also a risk that people are, how can I put this in a fair way, but there's also a chance that politicians are going on the ground and giving misinformation on the ground, because I have heard of some of these instances where it's like you can't access your SASSA grants if you don't vote for us. If we give you this thing, if we give you blankets, we give you this. What other ways can we look at educating people on the ground, and how can this conversation maybe happen in a different way? Is there maybe a clever way how we can distribute hope?
You know, I think hope is easy to distribute when we are all in agreement. You know, when I think about how my 92-year-old grandmother is still firm at saying she will vote no matter what, if she's alive in May, she is going there. And versus my younger nieces who would say they're not sure if they will, you know, and I think it's that whole feeling of, do you feel you belong? Do you understand? Have you come to self? I think I take it to a higher level to say, if you're not participating in your community, in your society, it means you haven't figured out what your value is in society. You haven't understood your impact, rather. Or why you're so important to be in that family, in that community, in that society. And that's why you will leave your power to other people to say, like we've discussed earlier, that no, because I know certain people will vote for that party, and then it doesn't matter if I vote or not. Education is really about us who do have access going back to those areas that don't necessarily have easy access to say, this is what's happening. This is my assessment, but really these are the facts of what these parties are saying. And, you know, perhaps I've been privileged to grow in a family that actually did debate some of these manifestos and to even wow. Think about when we first got into a coalition government where there was, I think, the breakaway from ANC during that time, where COPE was, established. And there were like rigorous debates about, okay, where do we think things are going? What do we think we could, who could we work with? And I understand that it doesn't happen even at a, you know, school level like that. But I think it's our responsibility to, and I'm talking about us who are interested, who are engaging the information, to take it back. I mean, you have a phenomenal platform here that can be a podcast, that can be shared on social media for people to reach. Facebook is still really a very prominent digital mechanism for many LSMs that can reach it. But if you think about the rural area, I disagree with the notion that they don't have the information. Yes, there is about almost half of our country that's dependent on government grants. And as soon as statements like that are made, it does make people nervous. But I think it's because we've also lost the sense of being, right, of our part that we take. And I love Dean Alfaghi's creed, where he says, I do not choose to be a common man. And I think we've come a long way with the kind of, you know, politics that we've had in our country, where people are really despondent because of their surroundings, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that you have lost all hope, you have lost all capability to change circumstances for yourself, like Bronwyn was saying. In a community level, it's much easier to navigate that. And I wonder if maybe that's the reason that, you know, when you feel despondent, you really don't have a community to connect with, because then you will be dependent on the state. And unfortunately, that's not a nice place to be, because I would say whatever happens, rather not be. The economic system, the capitalism system is designed in such a way that there will be people at the bottom. So it is my choice as a citizen to choose where I want to be, and the bottom is not an option. So, and that takes courage, that takes effort, and engaging. Unfortunately, countries are not built by individuals. It's a community effort, it's people who live in there. So if you think your vote it won't count, it means you don't believe in the community system. You don't believe with the people that you live with, or in the societies that you are in. And I mean, I don't know, like I really get upset when people don't participate. Like, in my mind, where do you think you live? And Bronwyn made such an important point. People are voting in their own countries for things to work. So if we're going to emigrate and leave our country, we're going to places that work because people actually have made their voices count for things to actually work. Do you get what I mean? So who's going to fix our problems if we're not taking it up? So, okay, pardon my premenopausal fluctuation.
Oh, we're all in that boat. Well, not all. I mean, I'm in that boat. I'm singing along and waving my way through. But listen, we've got a question from Rahima Valley. I'm going to hand it over to Bronwyn, and then we can all talk about it. But I also, if I may ask, when we do this, I would like to take this now as a conclusion, that we can talk about the hope aspect based on this question as well, because I really feel that we have so much to look forward to. It's a matter of hope cannot exist if there's no action. Action is so important, but I do believe that there's a lot of things to look forward to in our country. We live in a beautiful country, and one thing we've seen with sport is how we can unite. So why can't we unite by voting, even if we're voting for different parties that we're normally not loyal to, just because we're strategically trying to make sure that they are kept accountable, you know, based on their manifestos. Okay, so this is Rima. Good afternoon to all. As a question for the panel, what are your thoughts around most people having a sense that there isn't a political party worthy of a vote, or a party that could be trusted to truly carry out the needs of citizens and actually making a positive change, making it difficult to vote? To your thing, Kanisa.
No one denies that that is hard, right? But still, you've got to choose the best option on the menu that you've been given, or you've got to take more responsibility and start something of yourself. Run for local office, you know. If you don't like anything on the menu, you've got to cook something yourself. I mean, you know this. Most of us are women here on the call, and most of us generally, thanks to society, are in charge of making most of the menu decisions. You know, if you don't like anything on Uber Eats, you've got to cook something yourself, right? You don't want to hear that, but that's the choice. The other thing to note, so much like the sort of the economic concepts of like comparative advantage, that's what you're going to choose. You're going to choose the one that's going to give you the greatest comparative advantage. And it's actually quite a cute app. Like, it's almost works like Tinder. It's called YoGov. It's based on South Africa and matching South African political parties to your values, right? So it's not going to be perfect, just like on Tinder. And there's no man that's going to be absolutely perfect. But, you know, there's some that have like absolute deal breakers and red flags and other ones that you can work with, you know, like, and if you're voting, then you can work with them to work better next time. That's the way we've got to look at it. The other way to look at it is that even if there's nothing particularly appetizing on that menu and you don't have the energy to cook your own meal and to add something to the flavor over there, you've got to also realize that the problem with you not voting because there's nothing that actually is something that speaks to you is that you might end up with the worst thing on the menu then, right? But you don't have any control over that. Because even though there's nothing that you love, there's going to be something that you dislike more than what you like. And that's what you're effectively voting to prevent, right? To make sure that you're getting the best option of what we've got around us. And I know that's not easy, but at the same time, the more we do vote, and the more we do vote actually for smaller parties, I also like really challenge this idea that, well, you've got to work for one of the big parties or the major opposition, otherwise it's a wasted vote. Well, but if you think of it that way, then those big parties are going to remain big parties forever, right? And that's exactly what they want you to think, which comes back to the whole sort of opening apathy here and challenging those stories that limit our ability to use our agency fully for ourselves, right? And agency is one of those things that the more you use it, the more you get. You know, like what they say, unto whom much is given, much is expected. And also those Matthew effects take place. The less you use your agency, the less choice you have next time around. So maybe that smaller party that was the best of the worst chances doesn't make it onto the next ballot because nobody even took a chance on them, right? So we limit our choices by not choosing, even when our options are limited. But the more we choose, the more options that have spread out in front of us. So that's the way we have to look at it in those sort of branching effects. But although it feels so frustrating, sooner or later we get change. And this year we do have change. As I said, this is the first time in our democracy that the small parties are going to determine the future of this country. There is going to be some sort of a coalition. And we have a huge influence as to what sort of a coalition we're going to get, right? That's those numbers, suddenly there's so much more at stake, and there's also so many more different ways the coins can fall. You gotta take that chance.
Danisha, anything that you'd like to add to that?
Well, you know, we do live in this multi-state, multi-party state, which means that there is a diversity of opinions out there. There is a diversity of views. I think there's also a diversity on what kind of vision we have for South Africa in the future and how we're going to get there. But I really understand Rahima about what she's saying, because I think it is almost twofold, that responsibility. It's a responsibility of voters to be able to educate ourselves on what the various parties stand for. But at the same time, it's also an opportunity for the political parties to express what their views are, what is embedded in their manifestos. I mean, at this point, we still have, even though the opposition is maturing, we've got a rise in a multitude of new parties, but some of these parties don't actually have a fully fleshed out manifesto. And I think it is almost, you know, an opportunity for them to engage with the voter base to say that these are the things that we stand for. So I think it is a bit of a dual responsibility. So, you know, I agree with Rahima in that there is also responsibility on the part of the political parties that are contesting this time around, especially for the new players on the block, where we may not actually know what their value system is. We may not actually know what they are trying to promote and how they view the economy and how we are going to get ourselves out of an economic and socioeconomic rut. By doing so, I think, you know, there is this platform that we need to be able to create between these political parties that are contesting and the potential voters out there to talk about the problems that South Africa is facing, but to also come up with viable and creative solutions to these problems. So I think it really just creates an opportunity for us to talk about how to develop a more inclusive society, how to increase jobs growth, how to tackle the problem of structural reform efforts that are not progressing at a pace that's fast enough to actually pick up the pace of growth in a more substantial manner. You know, how do we go about creating a society where there's more security? Essentially, all of the issues that when surveyed by Afrobarometer, the population says that these are the main issues facing, you know, the economic environment and what's really pulling down the socioeconomic aspect of South Africa. So I think it really provides an opportunity. But again, I think it is twofold, that, you know, us as potential voters need to educate ourselves, but at the same and make ourselves present at these formats. I think Anisa spoke about it much earlier on. You know, we had where the political parties are going forward, you know, displaying their manifestos and engaging with the public. We need to be able to represent ourselves at these platforms. But at the same time, I think the political parties do have a responsibility, instead of just having, you know, a name and a logo, to actually have a manifesto to talk about the economic issues and how they're going to resolve it.
Excellent points. Thank you, Sanisha. Kanisa, what do you have to add to that?
I think we have to, you know, understand that these elections are on a national scale and also on a provincial scale, right? That means that we're more concerned about policy direction for the country, because at the local level, that's where the service delivery will occur, right? And I want to just challenge Rahima to say, in your community, have you individually now, and this is just a question that, you know, when I think about these kind of things, I say, do you know who your councillor is currently? Are you attending, you know, community meetings where you address things like load shedding, things like potholes, and what is your voice there? And I think that builds on confidence. When you start participating at that level, understanding that, okay, I know what issues my area has, and I know who the councillor is and what support they need. Because remember, my colleagues have already said, we have appointed or delegated the, I suppose, the execution part of our, you know, our voters to say, you be the leader, because I have other work to do during the day. I've got my family. I'm appointing you to take this job to make sure that my metropolitan actually works while I'm busy with other things. And then coming back to say, okay, so what are you struggling with? What do you need help with? It's a community thing. So I would challenge us here on the call to say, are we aware that once that national policy direction is given and the provincial allocations have been given, do we know who in our team mandate, do we know who is next to us is going to, you know, if there's any protests that are happening in your area, are you one of those people that are like, ooh, avoid this area, don't go there, and you don't even know what the protest is about? So I think, you know, it's nice to be aware of what's happening around you, but it's even better to be engaged. I'm not saying be the campaigner or start the campaigns, but what I'm saying is start participating, and you'll realize that you start meeting these different political leaders and you start understanding them at a personal level and understanding, and what that helps is to translate their manifestos as well with what they do. So you can already see if they're actually aligned with what they say they stand for and the actions that they do. And it makes it easier for you to kind of have a voice to say, okay, in fact, I think Sanisha and Bronwyn can work nicely together, even though they have different areas, but they all want growth for South Africa. So I like that. And then, you know, just narrow it down for yourself by just being active.
I absolutely love it. And, you know, each one of you have given so much valuable insights today. And, you know, actually, as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking differently about how I need to vote. But very importantly, what I'm taking away from today is the following. Your vote matters. Vote strategically. Also, it's okay to vote for small parties, because you need coalitions. Don't underestimate the power of smaller parties. What I'm also learning from this is debate manifestos with your family. I love that. That is such an incredible idea. Like, hello. I love that, because, you know, we're all told not to talk about politics, money, and all of those things in social circles. I think it's exactly the time. I think we need to change that old narrative. And then tender your party. Swipe right or left and just make sure. I love that. What is it? Could you put it in the chat for us? I love it.
Find your there, sure.
I love that. And I think that also participating in your community. I mean, if I just look at what's happening, we have meetings all the time where we have to go, and they really try and help us, over a month period of time, that we can actually all make it in the evening, all our time slots works to go and sit in these meetings. And it's so important to participate in order for you to bring that change you want to see. And I just think that all of this is so, so incredible. Any last points that you want to add?
Maybe I can just add, I think we need to be proud that South Africa is still a constitutional and parliamentary democracy. When we look at other countries that we would consider to be our peers, like the so-called BRICS nations, and we look at, the freedom in those countries, they rank far lower than South Africa does. And I think that we need to play our roles as citizens in order to uphold that.
Love it. Anything else?
Yeah, I think one last point, and that is that voting isn't only limited to the political realm, it also extends to our economic choices. We vote with how we spend our money, and we vote with how we spend our attention. That's something that I sort of reiterate quite a lot, and a lot of the conversation, especially Sinesha was picking up on earlier, was around the importance of voting for governments that are like economically open, that are open for growth. And if anyone is interested in that, there's a wonderful woman called Perth Toll. She's based in the US, but she comes from Asia originally, and she's got this amazing fund called the Freedom Fund that essentially chooses which countries to invest in. It's like an EFT or exchange traded fund based on their freedom weighting. So she looks at how open their governments are, how democratic they are, and she does quite well. So, like talk about sort of ethical investing in the future you want. It's really interesting to compare that to the voting for the governments that you want, because your government could end up on her list or not, right? Feature that you want there. So just think about voting and participation beyond just going to the polls. It really is about the sum total of the choices that we make, because that's what the future is. The future is the sum total of the choices that we all make together. That's what we end up getting.
Not true. Collective. Kanisa, I'm going to let you give your last points and then I'll close it off.
Thank you. I think I just want to reiterate the point that let's all be active citizens. Let's all be interested, invest in our country. And there's no better poem that I've learned over my life that I think talks to this point. It's by Dean Alfangen. Just allow me to read it. It's really quick. I do not choose to be a common man. It is my right to be uncommon if I can. I seek opportunity, not security. I do not wish to be a kept citizen, humbled and dulled by having the government look after me. I want to take the calculated risk to dream and to build, to fail and to succeed. I refuse to barter incentive for a door. I prefer the challenges of life to the guaranteed existence, the thrill of fulfillment to the stale calm of utopia. I will not trade freedom for beneficence, nor my dignity for a handout. I will never cow before any master, nor bend to any threat. It is my heritage to stand erect, proud and unafraid, to think and act for myself, to enjoy the benefit of my creation, and to face the world boldly and say, this I have done. Go out there and cast your vote.
This is beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. Oh my word, that was beautiful. Ladies, I want to send all my love and light to you, and I just want to say thank you so much for engaging in this conversation. I was a bit nervous because it is an uncomfortable conversation. I'm always uncomfortable when it comes to politics, but I'm trying to be bold this year. And I want to say thank you for all the valuable input. I've learned so much, and I also feel empowered. I really feel empowered today. And I just want to thank you for your time, especially before the Easter weekend. Enjoy your Easter weekend to our audiences. Enjoy, have fun, and have wine, read books, do whatever you need to do. Just have fun. Meditate. All right, everybody. Sending you lots of love. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.